This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you, maybe right down the street, maybe they're your neighbors, but they have incredible stories of the things that they've done for the sake of our freedom. And we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I think you might be blown away by the connection at the end of this one today. But let's start early on with Harold Lowe, 88 years old. Las Vegas, Nevada is where he lives now, but Peoria, Illinois, growing up. And that was the quintessential American hometown. What was it like growing up there in Peoria?
Well, Peoria was a town that was dominated by blue-collar workers. Caterpillar Tractor dominated the scene. During the first part of World War II, I actually worked part-time at Caterpillar after school.
Hmm.
They had a special bus that picked us up and took us to the factory. We worked weekends also, so we worked after school as well, and it was quite fulfilling to me because I was involved with athletics as well as the schoolwork, and I was a junior class president, felt an obligation not only to my class, but to the country.
Well, and I want to talk about that, and you were seeking to fulfill that obligation long before you became a U.S. Marine and long before you ended up with a Purple Heart. Did you have a big family there in Peoria? How many brothers and sisters?
Yes, I did. I had a brother and two sisters and two stepsisters. We had a large house, but it was crowded.
Uh-huh.
If you didn't appear for a meal on time, why, you might not get anything.
First in the chow line, huh? You better bust a move.
Yeah.
And how about the Cubbies? I know you're still a big Chicago Cubs fan. When did that love affair begin?
It began when I was just a teenager, and of course, we had no television. We were strictly radio. A lot of announcers broke in Peoria in the sports deal and went on to Chicago for fame. And so we had good announcers, including Harry Carey and Jack Brickhouse. The radio was real good. It gave you a real picture of the Cubs, and you couldn't help but love them.
Did you have a favorite player?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Gabby Hartnett, the catcher, was my favorite player.
Were you a catcher yourself?
No, I was just a pinch hitter, and they would put me in right field. At that time, they didn't expect a lot from a right fielder.
No, and at some levels, they still don't. Baseball on the radio, you're speaking my language. Did you ever hear that young fella around those parts named Ronald Reagan do a baseball game?
I never heard him do a baseball game, but I was aware of Ronald Reagan. Strange as it might seem, his father-in-law, Nancy Reagan's father, operated on my spine at the VA hospital in Chicago in 1947.
Wow. Well, and we're going to find out why he had to operate on your spine. But you're growing up in Peoria. You're a big Cubs fan. Gabby Hartnett's your favorite player. You love listening to him on the radio. But I imagine in December of 1941, you heard something besides baseball on the radio that changed your perspective a little bit. What do you remember about December 7th and finding out that the Japanese had attacked? How'd you hear?
Well, we heard it by radio, and believe it or not, there was a tavern open where next to the barber shop, and I was to get a free haircut. You paid for five haircuts, and then you got a free one. I think it was 20 cents or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But at any rate, the people in the tavern heard on the radio, and they came out exclaiming, you know, we're at war, and we've been attacked, and so forth, and I'll always remember that day.
I imagine you would. And you're just a teenager, what, 15 years old, I guess, at the time, huh?
Yes.
Did it rock your world a little bit? Was it a big eye-opener?
It was a very big eye-opener because my father was a veteran of World War I, and we marched in parades and so forth as sons of the VFW. And being patriotic at that time was not only in most of the families, but there wasn't much of a division like there is today with so many different people wanting the whole world to see it their way.
We could learn from that quite a bit, couldn't we?
Yes.
You mentioned your father being a World War I veteran. Did he ever tell you much about what he did during that time period?
No. I know he received a Purple Heart, which I sent on to my son Tommy, along with mine. And I know he was a sergeant, and he was a Browning machine gunner.
Uh-huh.
And he got wounded in the leg.
Somewhere in France, probably?
Yes, in France. It was in the Argonne Forest in France. The wound was pretty serious. It took him out of action until the end of the war. He was still in France, so.
Well, and I guess when you understand that, you probably feel pretty fortunate to be alive yourself, huh? Because if he didn't come home from that, you wouldn't be here.
That's true. That's very true. But at that young age, it was only after I got into the service that I realized what war was really like.
I imagine so, and I imagine your kids and grandkids feel pretty fortunate to be here themselves once they know what you went through during the war. But so you experience Pearl Harbor, this emotion behind your patriotism swells, and you said you went to work at the Caterpillar factory?
Yes, in East Peoria.
And so that was war-related duty?
That was war industry, and it was very tough. It was outside in the yards at Caterpillar where we took big idler wheels and put them on skids and took them to the machinery buildings and so forth.
That was for farm equipment, or was this for like tanks and stuff?
This was for tanks and stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, the farm equipment was out of the window until after the war.
And I don't know if people really realize that, but all of American industry really shifted into war mode. So things that might have been available before. For instance, automakers had a hard time getting metal for cars. But so here's a farm equipment company that all of a sudden is shifted into tank mode.
Yes.
And you're working on pieces of tanks.
Yes. You couldn't even get a metal box spring for a mattress set or any springs like that until after the war.
And you said before that this was very fulfilling for you. You felt like you were doing your part to help your country.
Yes, I really did. We had scrap drives at school where we took trucks out and picked up all kinds of metal, old car bodies and so forth. And it was just everybody. Everybody was in the war effort.
Mm-hmm.
There was no opposition, hardly at all, if any.
So you continue on. You said you're junior class president?
Yes.
This was Peoria High School?
This was at East Peoria Community High School.
All right. And so you're junior class president. You're playing sports. You're working at the Caterpillar factory. When did you start to think that the Marine Corps was going to be a good fit for you?
It wasn't just seeing a movie picture. I felt a duty. I felt that I really belonged in service at that time because I was strong physically, and I thought I was probably as good as any sailor or soldier that was in there. I had an older brother. He was already in the Army Air Corps at that time. And my father being a veteran of World War I, why? We were a very patriotic family. There was just no doubt about us. I enlisted at 17 with my father's signature.
And obviously with his blessing. What were your expectations? Did you think you knew what it meant to be a Marine?
I thought I did going in, but I was wrong.
What was the biggest wake-up call for you?
Biggest wake-up call when I got to Las Vegas and they took all my clothes away from me, and all of a sudden, well, you were really a lowly peon. You were there to learn, and they were going to teach you how to learn, and they were in complete control of your life.
I guess so. And here you are 70 years later back in Las Vegas. Go figure.
That's right.
And I bet you didn't expect, when you joined the Marine Corps, that your time overseas was going to be spent on a ship and not hitting the beaches.
Had no idea.
So how did it come about that you became assigned to the USS Colorado, a decorated World War II battleship?
Each platoon that graduated from the San Diego Recruit Depot, there was one person chosen for sea school, and I was that person. I don't know what all the qualifications were, but you had to have a decent IQ. After sea school, I was in San Diego when President Roosevelt came in his private railroad car and made two addresses. The last one was at Coronado. And from San Diego, he had a fireside chat with the American public. I stood presidential guard duty and relieved some of the Social Security men so they could rest and eat and get some decent food from a Marine Corps base. But I got to see the president. I didn't get to meet him. I met Fowler, his Scottish dog, and shook his paw. It was quite a meeting. From there, Roosevelt went on to Pearl Harbor, where he boarded a cruiser to go there. He didn't fly. And then he went back to Seattle. In the meantime, I went to Bremerton by Seattle and was put aboard the Colorado. It just came back from 10 a.m., and it was pretty well shot up. They lost quite a few Marines.
Yeah, I've read about that, that at Tinian, it did suffer 22 shell hits and had 43 men killed during that battle in late July. But I want to ask some more questions about this deal in San Diego. You're, what, 17, maybe not quite 18 years old, and you're guarding the President of the United States?
I am, with a M1 rifle. I'll tell you this, but no one will probably believe it, but we train not only with that, but with a Rising semi-automatic, with a sawed-off 12-gauge shotgun for anti-riot control, and the .45, besides our M1. We stood guard basically with the .45 and the M1.
And when you talk about that training with the sawed-off shotgun, this is specific to having to guard the president? That wasn't your general Marine Corps training. That was for that specific duty, is that right?
That's right. That's the only thing it was for.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
What did that feel like? What did that make you feel important? Was that a heavy burden on you to be partly responsible for the safety and security of the leader of the free world?
No, it wasn't a burden. I accepted it freely because I was such a good rifleman and such a good shot that I was ready to protect him no matter what.
Is that a pretty tense duty? I mean, are you on edge waiting for something to happen?
You're alert, but you're not on edge.
Mm-hmm.
You're alert.
You probably need to stay calm in order to carry out your duties.
That's right. Yeah. And you weren't to be reckless and go halfway off or so forth. You had to have a reason to do any defensive shooting or anything. But we had live ammunition,
mm-hmm.
and we were told to shoot to kill.
Just don't shoot that dog.
That's right.
And I'm sure if anyone has been to Washington, D.C. and seen the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Memorial, they know that Falla is part of that memorial.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a bronze dog right there next to FDR in his wheelchair.
I'll be darned.
So maybe you can go have a reunion. So you go up to Bremerton, you get aboard the Colorado, and this is a big battleship that's already scarred by World War II. Was that an adjustment for you to become part of the crew of that ship?
It was. I realized that I was taking the place of a dead Marine, and number one 20-millimeter anti-aircraft gun is my position. I was the gunner, and I had a crew of two. The three of us were very bonded together. We were very good.
How'd you get along with the Navy guys on that ship? Was there some rivalry because you were Marine Corps and they weren't?
No, it was wonderful. I used to make liberty with a couple sailors. They were both cooks, and that was to my advantage. They not only were great guys, but that meant that occasionally you might get a sunny side egg or a real orange or something.
So you know that this ship has experienced significant battle and significant damage.
Yes.
Did that make you a little anxious about sailing back into the Pacific, or were you looking forward to getting a piece of the action out there?
I was looking forward to getting into action because we were so well trained and we were so battle ready. We had knocked down flags that were drug past us with the cable holding a big cloth. We were just so good at everything that we knew we were ready.
And it didn't take you long to see action, and it didn't take you long to get hurt.
It was much quicker than I realized because it was our first engagement in Lady Gulf that we got hit by the two planes.
Tell me what happened. What do you remember about that day?
I remember we were on alert, and that there were planes coming in to attack our fleet. They expect them to approach from the rear of our ship because they had the structure of every ship and so forth, and they knew that was the best way to approach our ship with less fire. Fortunately, I was able to train my gun to fire back there, but I was the only one out of the five that could shoot back aft like that.
So only one of the guns was able to shoot toward the rear of the ship.
Out of the five in our tub.
This is 1944. The kamikazes weren't hot and heavy yet like they would be by the end of your tour when you were at Okinawa. Had you heard of this idea of a suicide plane attack before you went into that battle?
No.
So this is a completely new idea.
I was a teenager at that time, still in love with my hometown, even though I was in the Marine Corps.
So this is a pretty eye-opening experience at Lady Gulf. You're on a 20-millimeter gun?
Yes.
Your job is to shoot down airplanes?
Yes.
And the airplanes are coming?
And they're coming.
So what happened next?
The two planes that came in to our fantail, one we hit, whether I hit it or not, I don't know, and it just barely got aboard the ship. The second one, though, hit in a casemate on the opposite side of the ship. As it came in, why, it went farther to its left and hit right below our quad 40-millimeter count on that side of the ship.
It occurs to me that a lot of people listening have never been on a 20-millimeter mount on a battleship before, and they might not know how you operated that firepower. What was your technique? If you see a plane coming toward your ship, where are you aiming to try to knock it out of the sky? Because you don't want to knock it into your own ship either, I'm sure.
Well, you want to hit the plane regardless, which is very difficult. And if it still hits you, why, that's just fate. But you had a special sight, and the sight was very good once you trained on the plane. It allowed for the lead, and also through the sight, you could see your tracer bullets. We loaded in the magazine, which was 60 shells. We loaded 20 to 25 tracer bullets so that we could see where our shells were going. And, of course, everything was real quick. But the sight was very good. It allowed for lagging right away, and you were on target.
And I imagine a big part of that is a feel, huh? I mean, you have that feel for how fast that plane's moving, how far you need to lead it. You're watching that tracer.
With experience, you develop that feel. You don't have it at first.
Sure.
But as you get used to it, because the planes are faster than the targets that you trained on.
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming directly toward you.
And this is the very first time you've ever fired this weapon in combat.
That's right.
And two planes are coming right at your ship.
That's right.
We need to catch a break, but when we come back, we'll hear how that worked out for a then 18-year-old Marine. For photos and even a brief video with today's guest, Harold Lowe, check out Hometown Heroes Radio on Facebook. We'll be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 88-year-old Harold Lowe of Las Vegas, Nevada, originally from Peoria, Illinois. But in November of 1944, he was an 18-year-old Marine operating a 20-millimeter anti-aircraft gun on the battleship USS Colorado in Leyte Gulf in the Philippines. You said two kamikazes hit your ship there. Was it the first one that injured you?
No, that was the second one that hit on the opposite side, directly opposite my position, which knocked me from my mount against a ready box. On the lid of the ready box, it had a edge where my back hit and so forth, and I was damaged worse than what I thought.
How far would you estimate you were from the impact of that plane?
About 15 yards.
That's really stinking close.
Yes.
So basically a flying bomb, stuff is flying everywhere, and you go flying into this box. You hurt your back. Did you stay in your position?
No, I got knocked off my gun. The belt that went around my back may have done as much damage as the ready box because the impact knocked me like that.
Mm-hmm. So I imagine this is a pretty chaotic scene, and I want to remind everyone, you're 18 years old at the time. You've just seen something you've never experienced before. You're thrown out of your position. What did you do from there? I mean, that had to be pretty jarring and pretty upsetting.
I took a glimpse of our Marines down on the 40-millimeter mount, and the mount was practically destroyed, and seeing the men laying there in blood on the deck and so forth, especially the men that were mature, it affected me a great deal, and they got quite a few of them. I got a couple sergeants and a corporal that I was close to, and it was upsetting because I didn't know whether they were dead or they were going to survive, and unfortunately they passed away.
Yeah, what I read was that there were 19 men killed in that attack and 72 wounded, so you're one of those 72, but your focus was on the guys who weren't going home, and you said they were mature. These are guys that maybe were married, maybe some of them fathers?
All of them.
All of them?
Yeah.
So you knew that there were a lot of devastated families back home?
Yes. And I knew they were in the war to get it over as quick as possible because they had responsibilities, not only of the war, but of their family. I didn't have the responsibilities of a family.
So you're thinking about them, and that's so heavy emotionally. When did you realize how bad a shape you were in yourself?
I really didn't realize it. I knew that I was handicapped, but I didn't look at it as a handicap at all because I felt secure behind my gun mount.
Mm-hmm.
I just knew that I could shoot anything down and that if I didn't, somebody else would.
So were you able to get back into your gun mount?
Oh, yeah.
So yeah. You're hurt, but you go right back to your position and you're firing more.
Right. That's right. In fact, we changed the barrel on my gun because it was so hot. And we had a spare barrel there that we put into the gun right away and took our barrel that was red hot. They had asbestos gloves. They put that barrel in a sleeve like that had water in it that cooled it off.
Mm-hmm. So you don't really have time to feel sorry for yourself or to tend to your own injuries. You had to finish this battle till it was over.
You just did as you were trained. You had a secure feeling as far as to be able to defend yourself. You felt you could defend yourself as well as your partners aboard ship and the whole ship. You knew you were going to do your job, so you felt confident.
What was the extent of your injuries at the time?
The extent of my injury was that I just couldn't stand at attention if we had quarters. I couldn't lift anything, but I could fire that 20-millimeter gun.
Because it was your back that was hurt.
Back, and the pain that I had from standing behind the mount wasn't something that it just disappeared when you had other things on your mind.
Uh-huh. So you just lived with that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Because you guys had other battles to engage in. A few weeks later, you were shelling Mindoro?
That's right. We went to Mindoro, then Luzon, and then all the way up to the northern end of Luzon and then Guyan Bay.
And it was there that there was another significant tragedy on your ship, as I understand it.
Yes.
What happened there at Lingayen Gulf?
I'm not for sure of the origin, but we had a lot of shrapnel. The captain's quarters was hit with shrapnel, but there was, when you get that shrapnel going and it tears off steel, you get all kinds of strange things. And I had either shrapnel or a piece of bullet hit my nose and excessive bleeding immediately and so forth. And we were under air attack at the time.
Mm-hmm.
When it eased down a little bit, our captain told me that I had to go to sick bay to get it taken care of. And I went to sick bay, and the doctors were all busy with other people that were more serious. So a corpsman said that he's having trouble getting my nose back straight, and that without seeing a doctor, he was going to try to get it on straight, and He wasn't going to stitch or anything. He was going to tape my nose back right, which he did. He took his scissors and cut the gristle that was all frayed in my nose, got my nose back to where he could tape it on, and I went back to my battle station. 2 weeks later, when a doctor looked at it, why, he said that Corman did a great job, that he would have had to have stitched it, and I would have had a big scar there. It healed almost perfect.
I'm looking at it now. I can't tell anything ever happened to it. So,
yeah, you have to really look close.
I'll put a picture of you up on our Hometown Heroes radio website so people can see for themselves. So a little tape and a Corman was the best plastic surgery you ever had, huh?
Oh, it was great. I didn't realize it at the time because it limited my eating with the tape and everything all around my mouth. But the tape came all the way down here.
So you had tape from the bridge of your nose all the way to your chin, basically?
Yeah, he put a lot of tape on because he didn't want it moving around.
Right.
I'm just glad that he did. I don't know the Corman's name, but I often pray for him.
Yeah, he did you a pretty good favor.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly what you needed. But in that incident, that's January 9th of 45 aboard the Colorado, so you're wounded in the nose, and you're thankful for the Corman's treatment, but there were 50 others on your ship wounded, and if this number's correct, 18 killed that day.
Mm-hmm.
Did it ever get to you? Did it ever make you think, I might not make it home from this war? When you're seeing 19 guys die at Lady Gulf and another 18 at Lingayen Gulf, did you ever think you were going to be one of those guys?
At that time, it entered my mind because I lost a close buddy of mine from Chicago, Robert Anderson. He was the Admiral's orderly and also our captain of the ship's orderly. He was a close friend, and it was difficult to lose him.
He was hit by shrapnel at Lingayen Gulf?
Yes.
You talked before about the guys you lost at Lady and what that did to you, but I get the sense that this one hit you harder. You'd known him for a long time.
Yeah, well, ever since we got into service together, we were close, boot camp, sea school, and then we went aboard the Colorado at the same time.
I know some of these questions are difficult, and certainly this topic is difficult to discuss. But in 70 years since then, have you ever thought about what kind of life he would have had? What kind of man he would have been? Or?
Well, yeah, I've thought about it a great deal. In fact, his sister and his brother-in-law had a tavern in Peoria. I visited them a couple times, and this was after the war, of course, and it brought back memories where I couldn't go over and visit them anymore. I had to get over that stage.
Well, and I'm glad that you're sharing that with us. I know that's not easy to say, but people need to understand that the scars you bring home from war, even if your nose isn't scarred very badly, there are some other scars that you have to deal with. And the war wasn't over for you.
No.
You've been wounded twice now.
Yes.
But you keep going, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but I'm guessing that you guys had more action and more rounds to fire at Okinawa than the rest of them combined.
Yes. We were under air attack there consistently with kamikazes, and they came in such large numbers that our fighter pilots, even though there were many aces among them, they just couldn't bring them all down and keep them from reaching our fleet because of their numerous planes. We had a fear of what was going to happen if this kept up, if they were able to keep sending planes like that down. And it was only about 90 days later that we realized that they were running out of planes. Then we started taking aboard ammunition and so forth and so on to go on to mainland Japan. Just about everybody had a fear. We felt that may be our last battle, and how the outcome would be, we may not know, but certainly Truman and his decision was applauded by us.
Well, and I want to talk about that, but I don't want to gloss over Okinawa, because basically 2 months straight of being under air attack every single day, and your ship's bigger guns are bombarding Okinawa.
All
right?
The time, consistently. Yeah. We bombarded Okinawa more than any other ship. Not only that, but we lost our spotter planes. We had two airplanes on our ship that we launched. They had pontoons on them to where they could land on water when they came back, and we'd lift them back up on the quarterdeck. But Mm-hmm. We had a launch aboard the ship where these planes spotted our shells and so forth, and radioed to the ground what they wanted and so forth, and we gave it to them with the big 16-inch guns that we had.
Right. And you referenced that your ship fired more 16-inch shells than any other ship in World War II, but you're still on the 20-millimeter. Your job is to protect your ship from the enemy aircraft.
That's right. Keep those big guns going.
How did you do that day after day after day? What kind of mental focus and resilience did you have to do that? That, I mean, that seems really grueling and taxing to me.
Well, it was the greatest challenge that we had in the war, and after so long, you still got the fear. Anyone who says he's not afraid may not be telling the truth. I was afraid, but at the same time, you're just so well trained by the Marine Corps at that time, and I'm sure the Navy and Army was the same way. We had a certain pride, and it wouldn't leave you. You knew that you were going to do your job, and more if you had to. You weren't going to give up or anything like that, but you were able to think a little more clearly after being in battles like we were in for so long and so forth.
Did you ever hear from home? Did you get mail from your family?
It was sporadic, but yes. Yeah, I got a Dear John from a girlfriend, but we hadn't reached any stage of marital deal or anything. She was in high school and I was in high school, and I guess she wanted to date another boy and felt that she owed me a letter.
Well, at least she had that courtesy.
Yes, yes.
You mentioned your USS Colorado mug here that notes firing more rounds than any other ship. It also says that 11 Japanese aircraft were shot down. Do you look at any of those and feel like you had a hand in that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very definitely. I think it was hard, you know, to decide and give credit to what ship was doing down when you're part of a fleet. You just know that you contributed to many of them being shot down. Fortunately, I was in a fleet of cruisers and battleships and destroyers. We put up a lot of flak. Mm-hmm. It was difficult for them to get through, but there were so many of them that some did. It wasn't nice to look out into the water and see sailors or Marines from another ship that were floating in the water, and that happened frequently.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm just curious. Because so much of, I think, our perspective on war, and no one wants to go to war. I mean, no one wants to have to deal with it. And we often hear, well, how'd you feel about taking someone else's life and blah, blah, blah. But it seems to me in your position, even though you're operating a weapon that can inflict a lot of damage, your job really was to save lives. I mean, you're defending your ship.
That's correct.
Was there a particular incident where you felt that your work on that 20 millimeter, you know, in concert with all these other ships that are firing, really did save a lot of lives on your ship or another ship?
Well, yes. Yeah, because I was contributing to an effect that was successful in most cases. And where there's success, why, and you're involved in that, why, you feel good about it.
And I know you were wounded twice, and you have the Purple Heart to prove it. But I don't want to assume that that's what you would say is your closest call. When you think back of everything that you went through, is there one moment, one scenario that you feel like you came the closest to not coming home?
Well, when the shrapnel hit my nose, I wasn't really aware because of the tense situation at first. But after I had time to think about it, my nose, that was that close to within about 80 inches of my brain.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the severity of it at the time, I don't think I had any other reason to think but of the fact that, wow, that was close.
Well, that's close to a lot of things. It's close to your eyes. You could have been blinded.
Yes.
Close to your jugular.
Yes.
You could have bled out. Close to your brain, like you say.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the nose was the best place to get hit?
Well, if you have to get hit, why, I guess it's okay.
Especially if you have a corpsman with that kind of magic tape.
Well, not only that, but my nose wasn't too small anyway. Making it a little smaller kind of helped out.
That's the spirit. Seeing the glass half full, no doubt. And I don't want to make light of it, and you described it earlier, but maybe you can give us a deeper sense of it, too. I imagine this is a pretty bloody situation, right? When you get hit, you probably didn't know how bad it was.
I didn't. In fact, I didn't realize I had so much blood on me all over. And that's what the captain saw that ordered me to go to sick bay.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'd have just stayed on the station. And we put a little powder on the nose to keep from getting an infection right at my battle station.
Uh-huh.
But when he saw the blood on my uniform, well, he realized that I should go to sick bay.
And I know you're not trying to draw attention to yourself here, but I'm just picturing this, and I'm thinking, man, that would have been a great photograph of valor in the Pacific in World War II to see this Marine on his 20-millimeter mount with blood all over his face, and he's still firing away. And that's what you were, right?
Yes, that was it. I didn't realize it at the time, but that was the picture.
It's a great mental picture for us. Wish I had a real one. I do have some more recent photos relating to Mr. Lowe and his story on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page and also at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, a pretty amazing twist to his story that unfolded just in the past year. Back with the rest of Hometown Heroes after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our discussion with a passionate Marine Corps veteran of World War II, Harold Lowe of Las Vegas, Nevada. He served aboard the battleship USS Colorado in the Pacific. We heard about the two separate times he was wounded aboard that historic ship. You can find the bell from that battleship at the University of Colorado in Boulder, but there's a different memento that means a little more to Mr. Lowe. We'll hear about that in a minute.
And you mentioned a moment ago Harry Truman's decision. And here's a guy who inherits the presidency, has no idea that there is an atomic program, gets briefed on it, and within weeks has to make a decision whether to deploy it. But as you talked about your ship and all these others making plans for mainland Japan, if I read between the lines, I hear you saying that that decision to drop the bomb saved your life. Is that how you feel?
I do. In all probability, it did, and it probably saved the Colorado. We knew that the Japanese people had been trained as civilians to defend their country. It went right into the schools there. It wasn't like our country at all.
Mm-hmm.
We had been listening to Tokyo Rose on the radio, and she did affect a lot of people with her knowledge and everything. And, you know, Tokoros was an American citizen, if I remember right.
Yeah, from Southern California.
Yes.
Did she mention your ship specifically? Did you hear her talk about the Colorado?
She sunk us a couple times.
But that's probably good, right? If you hear that, you know the rest that she's full of it with the rest of it, if you know your ship hasn't sunk and she says it has.
Yeah, we laughed at that when we heard it on the radio.
Did you enjoy the music anyway?
Oh, yeah. The program was entertaining, but we weren't allowed to listen to it continuously. But we did get to hear it enough when we weren't at general quarters and so forth to get a little breather and enjoy it.
So the bomb was dropped. The second bomb was dropped. And you guys, I guess, were back at Okinawa at the time?
No, we were loading up just off of Okinawa to go to Japan.
You're on your way to Japan.
We were taking on supplies and ammunition and so forth, and I forget the name of the island, but it was kind of a sheltered little island west of Okinawa that we went to load up, and other ships were loading there too.
So that's where you were when you found out Japan had surrendered?
Yes. We found out that she'd surrendered, I believe it was in August. The peace treaty was signed in September the 2nd in Tokyo Bay. We were within eyesight of the Missouri and could see the ceremony. It was quite a day because our super forts flew over the top and so forth, and these big Mahdi planes were low enough to where you could really get a look at them. And I'm sure that it affected the Japanese people when they saw these mighty planes fly over in formation and the fighters and everything. It was quite a day.
That give you goosebumps, seeing all those B-29s up there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was like seeing the American flag waving.
Mm.
After the peace treaty signing, we prepared to take on prisoners of war that were in better health.
American prisoners of war?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, they were held by the Japanese, some of them as long as 4 and 5 years. And these were the better ones that were in better health that they felt could live in our quarters with our diet and everything. And the ones that were real bad went aboard hospital ships or big carriers that could maybe give them a better facility. We voluntarily gave up our bunks for any of them that wanted to. We were used to sleeping on a deck or just anywhere.
And what can you tell us? And you said these are the better ones, but I imagine it was still pretty jarring to see the shape that the better ones were in.
It was scary.
What did they look like?
They looked like bones. There just wasn't any meat on most of them and so forth. They were able to walk, use their arms and legs and so forth, but they were just so skeleton-like. When you see Holocaust victims, it's kind of a picture like that. They were really ready to die.
Yeah, they had been starved and beaten and tortured.
Yes.
And I imagine for a 19-year-old to see that, that's a pretty healthy dose of perspective, huh?
It made you really think. It made you really think.
So you had the privilege of escorting some of those ex-POWs back home to America.
Yes, some of them were so sick that we dropped a few off at Okinawa on the way back and a few off at Honolulu on the way back. And then we went under that Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. And it was a real treat.
I see the look in your eye as you say that. And you described the B-29s as like the American flag waving, and it sounds like the Golden Gate was that way for you, too.
Yes, same feeling.
So you're back in the States. What was it like to see your family again?
Well, I was so unsettled that they were glad I was back. But as far as being at the home with the my two sisters and the two stepsisters, it didn't fit in their minds. So I got home on Thanksgiving. By Christmas, why, they had a talk with me, and they felt it would be better if I made arrangements to move out and be more on my own.
And this is because of the effects that steady combat had on you?
That was part of it. I was a little wild. I didn't have a reputation in the neighborhood as being an angel. If I wanted to go somewhere, I didn't mind cutting through people's yards or picking an apple off of their apple tree when the apples were ripe, when there were all kinds of good ones on the ground. I still picked them off the tree.
But eventually you went to the university that Peoria is well known for.
Mm-hmm.
Bradley University. Was that with the GI Bill?
Yes, that was under the GI Bill.
And you met your wife?
Yes. She was the secretary to the dean of education there at the time.
Uh-huh.
Well, I knew her before I went into service.
Oh, okay.
She, incidentally, was the girlfriend of a friend of mine that went into the Marine Corps with me, Rex Cummings. She was a very nice girl.
Well, I'm sure your four children and all your grandchildren are thankful that you made it back to reconnect with her.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't be here otherwise.
Yes.
I don't want to leave anything out, and one thing I definitely want to hear about, you had a pretty big surprise here within the last year.
That's correct.
So when you got out of the Marine Corps, did you keep any of your uniforms? What'd you do with them?
Well, I had my Marine Corps uniform, and I had it in a cover to keep it. It meant a lot to me. I always kept it in the closet in my bedroom, and in moving from San Diego to Las Vegas, more than 10 years after the war, I didn't open up all my boxes when I got to Las Vegas or unpack them. And when I did finally, why, my uniform was missing along with some other clothes. So evidently a box had disappeared, no trace of it, but it was too late to file any claim or anything. I just had to accept it that it was gone.
About what year was this when you realized it was gone?
In the 60s.
In the 60s. Mm-hmm. So a half century ago.
Yeah.
And it bothered you that it was gone.
Oh, yeah. It was upsetting to me because I had no idea. I felt that eventually I would probably have that in my casket with me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Over the last 50 years, did you think about that here and there? Did it ever pop into your mind again?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially on Armistice Day when I see the men in their uniforms and so forth. Any military occasion and so forth. Even here in Las Vegas, whenever I saw the Thunderbirds fly, why, it brought back memories the Thunderbirds are from Nellis.
Yeah.
It always gave me a great feeling. I always smiled when I saw those guys.
Yeah, so here your whole life, so your father was a World War I veteran, so you'd grown up marching on Armistice Day your whole life. You think about this, so your uniform's been missing for 50 years, and then you get a phone call?
I got a phone call.
What'd they say?
They asked me a bunch of questions, and I really didn't want to answer anything. You know, they wanted to know my full name. And
sounds like a scam, huh?
Yeah, and was I in the Marine Corps, and what dates was I, and so forth. I didn't realize it at the time, but they had my jacket, and they had this information in one of the pockets.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just wanted to make sure that I was the right person that this belonged to.
On that phone call, did they eventually tell you, we have your jacket?
Yeah. First of all, they identified themselves. This was a retired gunnery sergeant from the Marine Corps and two of his daughters. The daughters bought this off of a program where it was advertised for sale.
Uh-huh.
Not knowing who it belonged to or anything, because of their father being a retired Marine and so forth, they thought that they would buy that for him as a present, a memento to kind of keep and so forth, and so they bought it. And then they found this paper inside eventually, and they talked it over with him, and they wanted to return it to whoever it belonged to.
So you get a package here in Las Vegas?
Yes. I wanted to open it right away, and my daughter says, no, don't open it, Dad. She says, it might be a story. I said, I don't need a story about my jacket, honey. She says, but other people might like to know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked to a veteran reporter on the Review Journal, and so he told me not to open it, to wait till he got there.
Yep.
And they appeared with a TV station here, as well as a newspaper photographer, and did a story and showed me opening it.
And I'll have that linked at hometownheroesradio.com, so you can go back and watch that moment, the moment that can't be repeated. What did that feel like for you to hold that after all those years?
I had a fear that it might be a joke.
Ah.
So I thought, God, if my uniform isn't in here. So I was so relieved that it was in there,
mm-hmm.
and I recognized it immediately. So then I felt very elated, and it made me feel very good.
I imagine it made you feel pretty good about the people who sent it to you, too, that they, 'cause they didn't need to do that.
No, they didn't. I thanked them. I tried to show my gratitude monetarily, and they absolutely refused it.
Mm-hmm.
They were just thrilled to death that it got home.
Have you been able to meet them or just talk on the phone?
Only talk to them on the phone.
Have you been able to visit the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C.?
No. I'm sure that it's a great feeling, especially to a lot of veterans, to know that their efforts weren't in vain,
mm-hmm.
that the country recognized it.
And I imagine if you did go, you would have some specific people to think about when you look at that wall of gold stars that represents 400,000 Americans who didn't come home.
Yes.
Those of us who weren't born yet, who weren't alive for all of this, what do we need to know about those who gave their lives, so many of them that you knew personally?
Well, the best thing is there's still enough of us to give them a direct experience of why they served at the time and what the conditions were and so forth, because so much of it isn't taught in the schools. And a personal history relationship with either a grandfather or someone else's grandfather is very important, because a lot of times the only way you can get the emotional feeling is from someone who's experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
A book can't do that to you ordinarily.
That's why this program exists. And before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country. And thank you for telling us a story that only you could tell us. When you think back on it now, 70 years ago, being wounded a couple times, all the close calls, did you ever feel like somebody was looking out for you?
When I had time, I did. I felt that more than ever, that there was a God. And it made me, I had some comfort to know that I wasn't alone.
What would you say you're most proud of?
I really can't say that I'm proud of anything that I did for the country, because in my heart, I know that being born and raised in the United States was more than offset by anything that I could give to the country. It's kind of a feeling of indebtedness that you owe it.
I know people can hear in your voice, and I can certainly see in your eyes how powerful that emotion is for you. And this is what you're talking about when
yes.
you said seeing the American flag or the B-29s or the Golden Gate Bridge. That's just your gratitude for the nation.
Yes.
What does America represent to you?
An opportunity for all the young people to live their lives fully, you know. They can understand the past. We can all understand the past. And that's part of being prepared to live the future. And when we absorbed how we got here, how other people made it possible for us to be here, I think that more people will realize the responsibility we have as citizens.
Amen. What a perfect way to express what I'm sure a lot of folks are feeling as they hear your remarkable story. That is Harold Lowe of Las Vegas, Nevada. We're out of time for now, but I hope that you're going to be joining us next time as we're reminded again, perhaps as eloquently as we were today by Mr. Lowe, that freedom is not free.